survived as popular folk sayings. For example, red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky at morning, sailors take warning. This is supposed to predict whether or not a storm is likely, but how and how well does it work? Actually, it's not immediately clear what this saying means in the first place. Since the sky is black at night and light in the morning, we can assume that the saying refers to sunset and sunrise. But aren't sunsets and sunrises always somewhat red? Are we to imagine our hypothetical sailors going about their business in a constant state of wary delight every single day? The key to this saying is to look at the part of the sky where the sun is not rising or setting. In other words, look at the eastern sky at sunset and the western sky at sunrise. The sunlight itself at sunset or sunrise is always reddish because it has to pass through more of our atmosphere, and this removes most of the other colors. In order for the sky to be reddish away from the sun, however, there needs to be moisture in the air, moisture that is possibly associated with a storm. Most storms move from west to east, so red in the eastern sky at night means the storm has already gone past, delighting our sailors. Red in the western sky at dawn means the storm is on the way. Our sailors had better batten down the hatches. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from Bob Blakely in Geological Sciences. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. I'm Don Glass.
First-round co-leader Trevor Immelman of South Africa fired another 4-under par 68 today and sits atop the clubhouse leaderboard at minus 8 as second-round play continues at the Masters. Tiger Woods was 8 shots off the pace when he left the first tee this afternoon. The Chicago White Sox open a 3-game set against the Detroit Tigers tonight at U.S. Cellular Field. St. Louis continues its series with the Giants in San Francisco tonight. And the Chicago Cubs are on a roll, and they're hoping Carlos Zambrano can keep them rolling when he starts the opener of a 3-game set against the Philadelphia Phillies tonight. The Cubs have won 5 straight, including a 3-game sweep of Pittsburgh. And Washington hosts Philadelphia tonight in the opener of their first round NHL playoff series. Meanwhile, 3 NHL playoff series resume tonight after a day off. Ottawa skates at Pittsburgh, New Jersey hosts the New York Rangers, and Minnesota is home to Colorado. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
It's 2:43. More than half of the world's northern fur seals live on 2 tiny Alaskan islands in the middle of the Bering Sea. The number of these seals has been dropping steadily for more than a decade. Biologists hope a new study will help them figure out what's gone wrong. An answer cannot come too soon for the Aleut natives who live there, Alaska Public Radio's Annie Feit reports.
In the peak summer breeding season, the fur seals on St. Paul Island outnumber humans 1,000 to 1. The imposing animals can weigh up to 600 pounds and are covered in dense brown fur. They crowd under rocky beaches like this one that surround the treeless island. But today's crowds are tiny compared to the 1950s, when hundreds of thousands more seals dotted the landscape. Greg Freitas is an Aleut elder who used to work as a fur seal conservation monitor. He says he first became concerned about the population a decade ago.
I checked the rookeries every day, twice a day, observing seals, counting them. And right there and then, I noticed the decline. I don't have to count them. I could see the areas where they used to occupy. Grasses are growing.
Aleut natives take a small number of seals each year for food. Brined seal flipper is a local delicacy. Other parts of the seal are used for clothes and crafts. In a modern twist on an ancient art, one local resident is now turning seal esophagus, which looks kind of like thin white leather, into stylish iPod covers. Freda says he can't imagine Aleut culture without the fur seal.
The fur seal is us. Without the fur seal, they used to say, we don't exist.
The fur seal population is now declining at the troubling rate of about 5% a year. And on a cold fall morning, four federal biologists are working to figure out why. They're trying to catch a female who's returning from a feeding trip. The animal has been outfitted with tags that will give the scientists a map of her movements during her days at sea. But first, they have to find her. Carrie Kuhn holds up an antenna, trying to catch her signal.
It's a very faint signal.
The biologists spend most of the day creeping along the frozen beach on their stomachs. When they finally find the seal, she's not happy. There are lots of theories on what could explain the decline, including environmental contaminants, ecosystem change, and even killer whale predation. Biologist Brian Fadley calls it an ecological puzzle.
You know, there are a whole lot of sources of mortality for these guys, and so far have been no easy way to figure out what it is that's really controlling the populations.
This new study will help determine whether the seals are finding enough food, which could be an important factor. The animal's favorite prey is pollock, but they compete with one of the largest commercial fisheries in the world. Concerns about pollock stocks triggered a significant drop in the number of fish the industry is allowed to catch this year. And for St. Paul resident Greg Freitas, the connection is obvious.
I blame the fishing industry. I mean, nobody's shooting them, and killer whale is not going to take all of them. So where's the rest going?
But the fishing industry says it's far too early to link the pollock fleet with the decline. Paul McGregor is an industry representative.
There's no doubt that the populations are declining, but that doesn't mean that the people that are conducting fishing operations are the reason for that. What we need to do is find out why the decline is happening before we start pinning the blame on somebody.
Biologist Brian Fadley agrees there isn't enough information yet to draw a connection, but he's optimistic his team can eventually figure out why the animals are struggling. For NPR News, I'm Annie Feit in Anchorage.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. The Center for Children's Books in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at the University of Illinois holds its annual Storytelling Festival tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. The Storytelling Festival is for grown-ups, however. The general public is invited. There's a modest admission cost. The festival will take place in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at 501 East Daniel Street in Champaign. Joining me to talk about the festival is Kate McDowell. She's an assistant professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So what happens at the Storytelling Festival?
Well, tomorrow night we'll have nine tellers and quite a range of tales, everything from comedy to tragedy, comedy including some classics. Our teller Sarah Sheppis will be telling Tom Whitewash's The Fence from Tom Sawyer by Mark Twain. We have a classic tragedy, actually, that's being told, a little unusual in terms of what you hear. We hear a lot of comic stories, I think, in our world today, but we'll be hearing Brunhild and Siegfried tomorrow night, which is one of the earliest Sleeping Beauty versions that occurred, that's been recorded, at least, by Atta Bird. And then Rebecca Krasnarich is going to be telling a fractured feminist version of The Three Little Pigs. And those are just three of the nine tales that will be available tomorrow night.
Okay. Now, are you one of the storytellers?
I am. And I'm going to be telling a version of the story about the old woman who lived in a vinegar bottle, which is about an old woman who is very unhappy with her home, and a fairy grants her a wish, and she's moved into a cottage, but she's not satisfied mm-hmm. with the cottage, and the wish is granted again, until in the end the fairy puts her back in the vinegar bottle. So it's, I think, a tale about happiness and how we rise or sink mm-hmm. to our level of happiness over
sweet
and over
and
again.
Sour.
That's right.
Right. Now, maybe you would tell us here something about the process of creating a story or learning it mm-hmm. and then practicing the telling of it and ultimately sharing it with an audience.
Yeah. Well, you know, storytelling is unusual in that it's not acting per se, so we don't encourage people to memorize word for word exactly what they're going to say. We do encourage, and I teach storytelling classes at the Library and Information Science Department, and that's Graduate School of Library and Information Science, and what I teach is the art of interacting with an audience with the knowledge of a story. So how the teller knows that story may be primarily language, it may be primarily in images, it may be that they have certain sounds that they're imagining as they're telling the story that are guiding them through the narrative. But the important thing about storytelling that I think differentiates it from, say, reading or acting is that it's about an interaction with an audience that is a live back and forth exchange, so that the teller with practice and training, and this is I think what makes the story really good, is that if you tell it to many audiences, you get used to the sense of when people are likely to react and how they'll react and how to build in space for your audience to truly participate in creating a story as part of that performance.
When and how did your passion for storytelling begin?
It started actually at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science back in about 1997. I took a storytelling class long before I was teaching them, and I had been attracted to the field of work with children in public libraries, especially because of my interest in children's literature. I also had a background in music at the time. And what really interested me as I started to play with storytelling and learn it was that, so having done lots of singing to kids in various contexts, everything from babysitting to summer camp, I'd done lots of playing guitar and singing with kids, I realized that the songs that I had that were really stories and that allowed children not only a chance to interact with the song by singing a little, but actually had a narrative that taught them something new or that took them to a place they weren't expecting, but a full narrative with a beginning, middle, and end, those songs were so much more powerful and gripping for my young audiences than the songs that were more like playing, you know, more like games back and forth.
Why do you think that is?
I think it has something to do with the way our brains are universally wired. I really do. I think it has to do with the power of narrative to express something that, you know, a good story expresses something, I think, that is at some level universal, while it's also very, very specific. There are great examples of this on NPR from This American Life. I think Ira Glass does a great job of that. And also the StoryCorps Project, David Isay. Yeah, and those projects, if you're familiar with those, actually, that would give you some sense of what we're doing tomorrow night as well, because, you know, at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, we do a number of courses in children's literature and things for children, but the art of storytelling, it's not always something for children, just like those projects, the StoryCorps Project and This American Life, aren't always, I mean, some things would be appropriate for children, but some things there aren't, and we try to give our growing student tellers, which is most of our performers tomorrow night, the opportunity to tell the tales that they're most passionate about and to be a little free from those age-appropriate constraints just for tonight. Now, that said, there's really very little gore and violence, but if you know the story of Brunhilde and Siegfried, you know it's an intense tale. It's dark.
People in every culture in every land tell stories.
Yeah.
You kind of wonder, what if we didn't have story?
Yeah.
Where would we be? We wouldn't be human,
yeah,
I guess.
I think that's true. Yeah, I think it is so much a part of our makeup. One of the things I love about storytelling as an art form is that we have, you know, my students are, I think of them as in training, but they're on the way to being sort of at a professional level. But really, anytime we gather at a dinner party or even at the end of the day, we're telling each other stories of what happened. So the art of making that something that you want to put, say, a concert about really is the art of practicing and refining something that we all do all the time. You know, it's not separate from who we are. The stories we tell seep into, you know, it's impossible to keep them. It's impossible to keep them down. They spring up in you know, every place.
Well, we need them to inform one another. We need them to teach. We need them to bond
with
one another.
Yeah.
Is there something that you can put your finger on in terms of what it is that makes us sit up and take notice of a good story? Why does one story really grab us and another one leave us cold?
Yeah. I think of it metaphorically. And that is that I think a good story takes you out of where you are right this minute, and the teller, whoever that teller may be, whether it's at your dinner table or at a big concert, the teller takes you into their experience and takes you on some kind of journey so that you're away from where you were at the beginning. There's even been a little academic study showing that people lose track of time when they're listening to a really good story. So when they're in this experience, it's one scholar has called it the storytelling trance, you know, that it's that kind of experience that we have. But I think we all know that experience of listening to someone and realizing that we don't know how much time has passed, you know, and that's what a really good story does. So the art of learning to do that, you just practice and practice and see what works. And you rely on some of the classics, too. I mean, I think that's one thing that we know works. We begin from folklore in the storytelling class because those are stories that have been honed over time, told by people through the ages. And of course, stories changing. We get stories off the internet now, and we tell those too. So, and we tell through typing, and we tell through YouTube, and we tell in all kinds of ways that are constantly evolving. So that too is a fascinating process to watch.
Yeah, there we'll leave it. We're out of time. Kate, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Kate McDowell is an assistant professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science here at the University of Illinois. The Center for Children's Books in the Graduate School is holding its annual storytelling festival tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. This storytelling festival, though, is for grown-ups. The general public is invited. There is a modest admission cost. The festival will take place in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, which is located at 501 East Daniel Street in Champaign. Again, Kate, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Earth and Sky.
Friday, April 11th, 2008. For the next couple of evenings, the waxing crescent moon pairs up with the planet Mars in front of the constellation Gemini, the twins.
As seen from mid and far northern latitudes tonight, they shine high in the southwest as darkness falls and stay out together until after midnight. From mid-southern latitudes, say in Australia, the moon and Mars appear low in the northwest at nightfall and set by late evening.
As you look at Mars tonight, you're looking at the place on our sky's dome where the sun resides in front of the constellation Gemini on July 7th. With calendar-like precision, the sun wheels in front of the stars of Gemini from around June 21st to July 20th every year.
The moon and planets also sweep in front of Gemini in predictable patterns, and all the while Gemini's background stars, with clock-like regularity, rise and set 4 minutes earlier every day. So it is in the heavens, with many patterns and cycles of stars, sun, moon, and planets superimposed on each other.
Not far from Mars on April 11th and 12th, you'll see Gemini's two brightest stars, Castor and Pollux. These two stars represent the starry eyes of the mythological Gemini twins. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Joel Block for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
You're tuned to the Information Advantage, AM 580. We're online at will.illinois.edu. In the WILL severe weather coverage area, a wind advisory is in effect for Champaign, Christian, Coles, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, Shelby, and Vermilion counties until 7 o'clock this evening, and in Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston counties until 8 o'clock. Tonight. Let's take a look at Mike Sola's forecast for the Champaign-Urbana area. Tonight, mostly cloudy, windy, and colder. The low 38, the wind from the southwest at 15 to 30 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy and cool with occasional showers, possibly mixed with snow at times. The high 45, the wind tomorrow from the west at 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts at 30 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, cloudy and cold with a chance of a few showers, possibly mixed with wet snowflakes at times. The low 32, the outlook for Sunday, mostly cloudy and cool, the high 43. The forecast for Illinois and Indiana is highlighted with a couple of advisories. A tornado watch in effect for northern Indiana until 9 o'clock Eastern time tonight. And as we mentioned, wind advisories in effect in southwestern, central, and northeastern Illinois and in the northern half of Indiana until this evening. Tonight's forecast for Illinois and Indiana north, mostly cloudy with scattered snow showers. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy with a few showers. Lows ranging from 30 in northern Illinois to 45 in southern Indiana. Tomorrow, cloudy and colder with scattered showers mixed with snow in the north, an inch or two of accumulation possible in far northern locations. Highs ranging from 36 in northwestern Illinois to 52 in southern Indiana. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frain is our technical director. And up next, it's The World from PRI. Stay tuned.